We're going to begin by reading Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 to 42 this morning. If you want to turn over there, Matthew chapter 5, verses 38 to 42. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I tell you not to resist an evil person. But whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. We're in that portion of the Sermon on the Mount where Christ is explaining what it means to be a Christian. What does a disciple of Christ do? What do they look like? Now, 60 years ago when I was a kid, there was a lot of preaching on this subject, especially as it pertained to young people. And what I grew up hearing back then was that to be a disciple of Christ, you're not going to drink, you're not going to smoke, although that wasn't strictly enforced because a lot of Christians smoked back then. You're not going to dance. You're certainly not going to dance. Maybe, depending on your home, you're not going to go to movies. I've got a good friend over in Indianapolis, several years older, whose mother always referred to movies as hell holes, and no daughter of hers was going to go there. You're not going to listen to rock music to be a disciple of Christ. And depending on other issues, you might not wear makeup, you might not wear jewelry, certainly no mixed bathing. And what they really meant was no mixed swimming. I don't know why they called it no mixed bathing, but no mixed swimming. Skirt length was set for the girls, hair length was set for the boys, and you would become a Christian by attending to those matters. That's what I grew up hearing. But Christ, when he gets around to talking about what does a Christian look like, what's involved in being a disciple of his, doesn't talk about those specifics. He talks in bigger principles, bigger truths. And so what we've been looking at, starting with verse 21 down through verse 41, of 37 of this chapter, is that being a disciple of Christ means we're going to condemn sin in all of its stages. We're going to condemn everything that is involved in any particular sin. We're not just going to condemn murder. The Jewish rabbis said, thou shalt not kill, by saying, don't ever literally kill someone. Christ goes far beyond that. Christ says, not only are you not going to kill anybody, you're not going to have the attitudes, the feelings, the thoughts that can grow up into killing. You're not going to be angry without a cause. You're not going to have contempt in your heart for a brother. You're not going to kill him. You're going to stop the sin of murder as soon as it appears. Christ said, you're going to stop the sin of adultery as soon as it appears. You're not going to indulge in lust. You're not going to give in to lust when it conceives. James says, as soon as a feeling or desire conceives, acts on the thought or the feeling, sin is what results. And it may be baby sin at that point, but sin always grows. Sin always gets bigger. And so to be a disciple of his is never to condone sin, whether in regard to our feelings that could lead to murder or thoughts, feelings that could lead to adultery at any stage. And then last week we talked about truth-telling. Truth-telling is one of the big issues of this day and age. You may not realize it, but it is, because trust is based on telling the truth. And without trust, we don't have the basis for a functioning society. Fundamental to all human cooperation is this matter of trust. It's the glue that allows us to cooperate with each other. It's what enables human interaction. If you ask me for a dollar, I loan you a dollar and you pay me back when you said you would. Next time you ask me for 10, I'll be more likely to loan you 10 based on how you paid me back for the dollar. And trust is the willingness to project past experience into future action, into future reliability. I'll give you a loan in the future because you've shown I could trust you in the past. Think about all the methods that have been devised to detect fraud and lying and untruth. Now, the best truth detector is when God Himself steps in, as He did in the case of Achan, who took some stuff out of Jericho he should not have taken, as He did in the case of Gehazi, Elisha's servant, who was covetous and God struck him with leprosy, as He did in the case of the old prophet of 2 Kings 13, who lied to a young prophet, and God sent a lion to kill the old prophet, as He did in the case of Ananias and Sapphira. He struck them dead right there in the church building, so to speak. And when God steps in and takes divine action, that's the best way to detect truth. There's a very interesting case of truth detection in Numbers chapter 5, verses 11 through 31. Trust in a marriage is so essential. And in Numbers chapter 5, here's a man who suspects his wife has been unfaithful. He takes her to the priest. She's not admitting to anything, but he suspects it. He takes her to the priest. The priest takes some dust from the floor of the tabernacle and mixes it with water, and the woman drinks it, this muddy water. And the text says that if she is guilty, this is what the priest tells the woman, if you're guilty, the Lord will put a curse on you, your thighs will rot, your belly will swell, essentially you'll be childless the rest of your life. Now there is no example of any Jewish husband ever trying to prove his wife guilty of adultery in that way. But that was a truth detection put there into the law of Moses. Lying is so prevalent in our society that you can't just cash a check anymore. You know, when I was a kid, you go to the grocery store, you get your groceries, and they tell you, you just write a check out and hand them a piece of paper. And the grocer would accept that piece of paper with your name on it because the grocer believed you were trustworthy. But so many bad checks were written, you just can't write a check anymore. Now, you can write a check, but it will only be accepted if it goes through that little machine and is verified. That's where it's gotten in our society. We have other measures that we use to detect fraud. You have to have a code. You try to get on Amazon to order something, and they'll email or text you a 6-number code that you have to then enter to prove that you're actually the person contacting them from your email address. Hackers. So many people can hack our identity that businesses require extra protection to make sure they're not being lied to. And the greatest threat of all in regards to trust and truth-telling is this AI business. Manufactured intelligence, artificial intelligence. Because AI has gotten to the point where we cannot use the gold standards of verification any longer. Namely, we cannot trust our eyes, we can't trust what we see, we can't trust what we hear. When Facebook first became a thing, I pretty much believed everything I saw on Facebook. Now I don't believe anything. If I see some celebrity on Facebook, If I hear them talking, chances are what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing was artificially created by a computer. You're not looking at the real person. You're not hearing the real person. Satan is the father of lies. And he has worked overtime to get civilization to the point where we can't trust our eyes or ears any longer. Now, they always figure out a way to authenticate. There will be tests that will be devised. I mean, college professors no longer can be sure that the paper their students turn in were papers the students actually wrote. And already threats are being made by professors and by schools. If you turn in a paper that the computer produced, zero, you're out, end of discussion. There will be other methods that will be devised to help us ascertain and verify whether one's telling the truth. See how far we've come from just requiring a man to swear by the name of God. That's what we talked about last week. So the third, Christ talks about murder, he talks about adultery, he talks about telling the truth, and for us right now, most of us are most affected by the matter of truth-telling and by wicked people, evil people taking advantage of technology and whatnot to deceive us. But now we've gotten to verses 38 through 42. Christ's first big principle is that a Christian is someone who is going to condemn sin at every stage, at every point that leads up to the actual act. But his second big principle is that a Christian is going to be someone who goes above and beyond what anyone thinks they ought to do. He's going to go above and beyond what logic, what common sense, what society expects of you. We've already seen him introduce this when he was talking about murder. Back in verses 23, there, Christ says, if you take your gift to the altar and you remember, you're going to church and you get there and you remember your brother's got something against you. Here's the way that often happens. Somebody gets irritated with us about something. They don't come and complain to us. They complain to somebody else. And the somebody else might come tell us directly, or they tell someone. And sooner or later, someone says, do you know what so-and-so said about you? That's how we most often find out, I think, that somebody has something against us. Now, common sense logic would say if you've got something against another, it's your responsibility to go talk to them. If they've got a problem, they need to bring it up to you. It's not your job. You didn't do anything. You don't think you did anything. You don't have any problem with them. They've got a problem with you. They should come to you. That's what thinking normally says. Christ says no. If you get to church and you know that a brother there has something against you, you stop what you're doing, you go find him and be reconciled to your brother. That's what it means to be a Christian. You're going to do what nobody expected you to do. You're going to go above and beyond what anyone would expect you to do in order to be reconcile, to fix a problem between you and another. And in teaching that, Christ is underscoring how important it is, the command, that we are to love our neighbor as ourselves. We are to love our brother. We're to love our enemy. Our relationship with each other is so important that if we've got a problem between us, we cannot be right with God. There is no use engaging in worship to God when we've not fixed some matter between us and a brother. That's the larger point that Christ is making. So now we've gotten down here to verse 38, where Christ is going to stress that his disciples will go above and beyond the call of duty. And he begins out with a statement that appears three times in the Old Testament. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Three times the Old Testament says an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now that was the law of justice. That is the law of fairness. What can be fairer than if someone knocks out one of your teeth, you knock out one of his? His carelessness, or maybe he was angry with you without cause, and next thing you know, he's taking a swing at you, and he hits you and knocks a tooth out. What is more fair than that he forfeits one of his teeth for one of yours? That's equitable. That's just. And Christ says, you've heard this said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Now when we go back to the Old Testament and look at the passages where that statement is found, what we learn is that it involved personal conflicts. It did not involve crimes. For instance, if somebody, stole one of your sheep, committed the crime of theft, the penalty that the law of Moses required was that you give him four sheep in return. Now that's more than an eye for an eye. But that was a criminal act. This principle, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, involved personal infractions. Personal disagreements, arguments, conflicts. And when someone harmed you, you did not take matters into your own hands and saying, you just knocked out one of my teeth, I'm going to knock out one of yours. No, you went to the judge. And this principle, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, was the penal guidelines for judges in Israel in deciding a case. You'd walk in with an eye patch, you're missing an eye, and the judge takes a look at that and he says to the guilty guy, okay, we're taking out one of your eyes. Now, I don't know that that ever happened that way, but that was the guideline, that was the code. The crime was to fit the punishment. That's what an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth meant. The crime was to fit the punishment. So under the law of justice, there was equity. The punishment fit the crime. There was fairness. And that's the way conflicts between people in Israel were decided. But Christ says, no, to be a Christian, living as a Christian goes beyond that. Remember back in verse 20, what he's telling us here is that our righteousness, how we live, how we conduct ourselves, how we behave, is to exceed the righteousness of your Jewish rabbis, the scribes and Pharisees, who taught that you only violate the sixth commandment if you actually murder someone. You only violate the seventh commandment if you actually commit adultery, and that leads to a divorce. And you only violate the commandment to tell the truth, not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, if you break a vow. Christ goes far beyond that. That's where the Jews stop. Christ says Christians are going to go farther than that. And boy, does he illustrate it here in verses 38 through 42. He gives four examples. And in each case, we, as Christians, are to go beyond what the law of justice would say in that situation, beyond what anybody would expect us to do. We're to get to a different level, a higher plane, a higher level. I'll tell you what that level is here in just a minute. But here are the four examples. Example one. Someone smites you on your right cheek. Now, if I got angry with you about something and decided to take a swing at you, I'm right-handed, most people are right-handed, I'm going to take a swing at you, I'm going to hit you on your left cheek. But Christ says, if someone smites you on your right cheek. Now for a right-handed guy to smite someone on their right cheek, we're going to have to backhand them. And the backhand for as long as anybody knows, has stood for an insult. To backhand, we even have the term a backhanded insult. To backhand someone is to insult them. Christ says, when that happens, you're to turn the other cheek. Resist not evil. That's what he says here. Does that mean if a lady's walking down the street with her purse on her shoulder and a guy runs up and grabs her purse and tries to run off with it, that she can't pull back? Is that what that means? Because she'd be resisting evil? If thugs break into your home and they're threatening your wife and children, you can't protect them because to do so would be to resist evil. And Christ said, resist not evil. Is that what he's talking about? No, he's talking about personal infractions that are very practical, that occur regularly in normal life, such as being insulted, being slighted in some way. When Christ was struck in the face during his mistreatment before his crucifixion, he did not turn and offer the other cheek. Very politely, he said, tell me what I've done wrong. That's how he responded to it. But he didn't insult anybody. Peter, 1 Peter 2 said of Christ, he did not return railing insult for insult. The Christian is not going to respond in kind. Eye for an eye, tooth for tooth was a response in kind. I'm going to do to you what you did to me. Usually, though, we want to do more to them than they did to us. A Christian is not going to respond in kind. He is, the law of justice may respond in kind, but Christians live by a different law. And then Christ talks about number two, a man takes you to court and sues you for your tunic. A man's tunic was his shirt, sometimes a long shirt that he wore. And he had a outer coat called the cloak that when it was cold or rainy, he had put that on over his shirt. Under the law of Moses, you could sue a man for his shirt. Now, many of you would, guys here might like to have this shirt, but you're not going to get it. But you could sue a man for his shirt, but you could not sue him for his outer coat. Your cloak was an inalienable right that no man could take from you by law. I mean, when you're traveling at night, and there's no hotel nearby, that was your blanket. When it rained, that was your tent. Your cloak served many purposes. No man could take that. But Christ says if somebody goes to the expense of getting a lawyer and taking you to court for your shirt, give him what he can't get by law. Throw in your cloak. And then Christ says, if you're compelled to go 1 mile, go with him twain. Go 2 miles. This came from an old Persian Pony Express custom. The Persians were the first ones to think about delivering the mail in a Pony Express kind of way. And if something happened to a pony, for instance, when you're to trade horses, and there's something wrong with the next horse, if anybody else had a horse around, you could, as a postal worker, impress their horse into service and use it. But then it was applied not just to horses and livestock, but to men. If a Roman soldier was assigned to Judea, and he's got his luggage, he gets off the boat there at Joppa or Caesarea, and he's got luggage, he's got to walk up to Jerusalem, you know, number of miles away. He could grab a Jew and say, carry my luggage for me. And the Jew by law had to do so for 1 mile. But when the Jew got to the end of the mile, he could set the luggage down, walk away, and then the legionnaire had to grab somebody else. The man compelled you. When Christ came out of Jerusalem carrying his cross, he staggered and they compelled Simon of Cyrene to carry his cross. If you're forced to go 1 mile, you go two. And then if a man wants to borrow money from you, now remember the context, resist not evil. We're not talking about a buddy, a friend, a family member, a trustworthy guy. We're talking about an enemy who wants to borrow money. He's in need. He needs help. Christ says you help him. Doesn't matter what he's done to you in the past. Doesn't matter if he already owes you money that he's not repaid. You help him. The common thread in each of these vignettes, these little pictures that Christ gives, is that the person who is being wronged is the one who takes the lead and goes beyond what anyone would expect him to do in response. You're not going to fight back. You're not going to insist upon your rights in court. You're not just going to stop at the end of the mile. You're not going to say no to the guy who's cheated you out of money in the past and is needing more. You're going to do what justice wouldn't require you to do and what most people would not expect of you. You're going to help. You're going to take it. You're going to defer, concede, even though you're getting the short end of the stick. Now, when we have said that, what are we saying about the law that a Christian lives under? What kind of a law is willing to take abuse and hang in there and keep taking it? What kind of a law gives more than it ever gets in return? What kind of a law goes farther than anyone would expect it? What kind of a law would help someone who's done nothing but hurt you? How about the law of love? How about the law that Christ lived by? How about the law of 1 John 4:10? Herein is love, not that we loved God, but that He loved us and became the propitiation for our sins. Christ, in love, took the first step. He didn't wait for the guy who had something against him to come. Knowing that somebody had something against him, he sought him out. He went looking for him to be reconciled to him. Despite the lack of appreciation, despite the lack of gratitude, thankfulness, the abuse, he was always refusing to respond in kind, doing more, showing love and grace in every situation. That's what verses 38 through 42 are talking about. Love goes above and beyond. The law doesn't. The law doesn't expect us to go above and beyond what the law requires, but love does. Love will serve, love will sacrifice, love will be insulted, love will be shown ingratitude, love will be taken advantage of, and it will still act lovingly. That's what it means to be a Christian. And so while we get hung up with these, you don't drink, you don't dance, you don't do this, you don't do that, Christ is wanting us to think in much bigger ways, embrace larger principles, and always in our dealings with others act lovingly. And in our next study, next week, Lord willing, we'll see that when He tells us to love our enemies. It's easy to send Christmas cards to those who send Christmas cards to you. But the Christian is going to go beyond that. He's going to do more, what's not expected. He's going to love his enemies. We'll look at that next week. Well,